Leave it out, says the lead headline in the Irish Daily Star. The paper reports that pubs are in turmoil again, as Gardaí say outdoor pints could be illegal. Similarly, the Irish Daily Mail headline speaks of a Garda blow for outdoor summer. Pub and restaurant owners have been left infuriated by a glaring government oversight that means it is illegal to serve alcohol in new outdoor seating areas, the paper says. On the other hand, the Irish Daily Mirror in its lead story reports the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar as saying yesterday that people who are not vaccinated can still holiday abroad this summer. He added that the government differs from the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Holohan, on this question. Vac your bags, says the headline, over a photograph of a crowded beach somewhere in Spain. This difference of opinion is considered in the Irish Independent's lead story. The paper reports that what it calls a worrying reluctance to take the COVID-19 vaccine among a sizeable minority of young people and conflicting official advice about summer travel is compounding the challenges to defeat the virus. A third factor, the Independent says, is the worrying spike in infections with the Delta variant of COVID in many European countries. Housing for All, the government's new housing plan to be announced next month, gets a preview in the Irish Examiner's lead story. Daniel McConnell reports that it will give elderly people incentives to downsize, remove height caps in cities, and bring 90,000 vacant units into use. The plan will, he says, aim to deliver 33,000 homes a year by 2025. The Irish Times leads with a report that the government is set to make renewed efforts to explore the acquisition of lands where the new National Maternity Hospital is to be built. Well-placed sources said that the state would engage with St Vincent's Hospital Group and the Religious Sisters of Charity, which owns the land in Dublin 4, and the paper expects that talks could begin this week. Jeffrey's grand plan, says the Belfast Telegraph headline, taking a familiar tone with Sir Geoffrey Donaldson. The paper says he is set to come home to lead the DUP from Stormont after stepping down from his Westminster seat in the autumn. Two documentary series about the killing of Sophie Toscan du Plantier in West Cork in 1996, one of which was released yesterday, get much coverage. Dan Linehan's photograph on the Examiner's front page shows a smiling Ian Bailey at the farmer's market in Skull, County Cork, yesterday. Mr. Bailey was found guilty of the murder when tried in absentia by a court in Paris, but has always maintained his innocence, as Greg Murphy reports. And he has said he probably won't see the Sky series about the death of the French filmmaker because he does not receive that channel.
Have an outdoor summer, the government and NPHET advised. But now it appears that efforts to enable pubs and restaurants to spill out into outdoor seating areas may be against the law. Gardaí say the consumption of alcohol in these spaces is not permitted unless specifically provided for in a liquor licence obtained in court or where bylaws permit the drinking of alcohol in public. The Minister for Justice, Heather Humphreys, said on Twitter that Gardaí will engage with licensing premises and will use their discretion as they've done throughout COVID. In Galway, a number of pubs were told by Gardaí they were in breach of the law. Now, during the programme, we'll hear from the Garda Representative Association about this. We'll hear from the Vintners Federation. But first, I'm joined by Adrian Cummins, the Chief Executive of the Restaurants Association of Ireland. Adrian, good morning.
Good morning, Mary.
So what's your reaction and the reaction of your members to this news that the licence that they have may not cover the business that they are currently transacting outdoors?
There's deep frustration and disappointment from our members right across the country, and specifically in Galway, because this is where the issue has arisen now. It could arise in other parts of the country later today. This is a big issue now for the government. We were all informed a number of weeks ago that outdoor hospitality and the summer of outdoors was the narrative that the government was using. They have invested 17 million euros in outdoor hospitality and dining through the Fáilte Ireland grants being distributed through local authorities. This is a deep disappointment and for our industry, and it's an impediment to how we operate our businesses. We cannot operate indoors until the 5th of July as per the roadmap to reopening, and businesses need to open and trade viably now, especially in West Coast counties that need a good summer to create enough income to keep their businesses afloat in the wintertime.
Were you aware of this difficulty? Were your members aware that you really are dealing, I think, with two sets of legalities, that the court issue around the licensing law and the bylaws in each different local authority area?
Well, everybody knew that that the Public Health Act was the piece of legislation that the government was using as we went through COVID. And I think the government should have known about this when they allowed outdoor hospitality to reopen. And the issue now today that we all face is that the Gardaí will use their own discretion, and the key word is discretion, as we go through the next number of weeks until we reopen indoors. And even when we open indoors, we need to fix this problem, because if the government have invested so much money in outdoor hospitality, it will have been pointless for our industry to put that amount of millions into capital expenditure, because we need to have a viable industry to operate. The government now, and specifically the Minister for Health and Justice, needs to, in our opinion, bring forward a statutory instrument and write it today and bring it into provision, so that this gives guidance for the Gardaí, that they have a legal right to, and businesses have a legal right to provide alcohol to within their designated area in an outdoor space for hospitality from today.
But in fairness, Adrian, to An Garda Síochána, in their statement, you know, they talk about continuing to adopt the approach that they've adopted throughout COVID, which is this 4 E's: engage, explain, encourage, compliance, and the last resort is enforce. There is no evidence, or is there, to your knowledge, of restaurants, outdoor areas being closed down by Gardaí?
No, but
unless there were public order issues.
We shouldn't be talking about this issue, because if the Gardaí in Galway City are going around to licensed premises, including pubs and restaurants, and informing them that their outdoor area, they cannot provide alcohol to their seated area as per the government's permission that was being allowed to do so, well, then we have an issue that we could come up right across every county in Ireland. What we want to make sure is that when businesses open their doors today, they understand very clearly that they're allowed to operate their business. Okay. That's what we want.
So it's back to the clarity you spoke about at the start. Just finally, what's happened? Your own, you had a threat of legal action in relation to the later opening of the restaurants as against the hotels. Are you pursuing that?
We are, and we're in court today at 11 o'clock with that case. We were in last Friday is seeking leave for a review. We're pressing on with it. It is a discriminatory case between allowing hotels to open first, and we are still only allowed to open outdoors, and we still haven't been given the green light by the government that we will open on the 5th of July. We're 2 weeks away. Businesses need to plan. We don't even have the guidelines yet to how we're going to operate in 2 weeks' time.
Okay.
So we're pressing ahead with our case. We've said that we were going to do so, and we're in court today at 11 o'clock.
All right, Adrian Cummins, Chief Executive of the Restaurants Association of Ireland, thank you.
Nominations will close tomorrow for the next leader of the DUP. Edwin Poots resigned last Thursday after a majority in his Assembly party refused to back his decision to nominate Paul Given as First Minister, following an agreement with the British Government and Sinn Féin to introduce legislation on the Irish language. We are joined now by writer and commentator Sarah Crichton. Sarah Crichton, will Geoffrey Donaldson run, and will he be the only contender?
That's expected, yes, Audrey. Yes, he's expected to. The nominations close in a few days' time. He's expected that he's going to be DUP leader by Saturday. And the word is that it's going to be a coronation, as they say, rather than a contest, and that he's going to move in and begin the process, really, of restoring the DUP's credibility and restore order to the party after the mess of the last couple of weeks.
Will he be First Minister?
He says that he's going to. So the plan is, obviously, Geoffrey Donaldson is a Westminster MP, so he can't be First Minister at this moment in time. So what they're saying is going to happen is they're going to ask Paul Given to resign, and then they're going to appoint another MLA. It's been mentioned this morning that Gordon Lyons, who's another MLA, might take that spot. And then what will happen is Geoffrey Donaldson will then have to be co-opted into a Northern Ireland Assembly seat, which means that he's going to have to resign from his Westminster seat, which is obviously going to trigger a by-election. So there's going to be this very interesting process now of getting Geoffrey Donaldson from Westminster over to the Northern Ireland Assembly. And there's going to be some pitfalls along the way, because in his Westminster seat, he's under quite a bit of a threat, really, from the Alliance Party. So it's going to be interesting to see whether the DUP can actually retain his Westminster seat if he does go to the Assembly.
And where would he be an MLA then? What constituency would he sit in?
There's a lot of different. You know, they're not entirely sure, but people do think possibly Fermanagh South Tyrone has been mentioned, which would obviously be very different from Lagan Valley. You know, there's lots of different rumours that maybe there's going to be some MLAs that might not run in next year's Assembly election. So that's not clear at this moment of time, but it seems that there is going to be a vacancy coming up in the next few weeks or so, or at some point in the future that Geoffrey is going to be able to move into.
And that by-election then that you mentioned, Sarah, in Lagan Valley, which would follow his resignation as a Westminster MP, what would he be able to present as a win to the electorate for them to retain that seat?
I think it really depends on what the election is fought on. I think, you know, Alliance are going to really push, I think, the political instability in Northern Ireland at this point in time. I think, you know, they're going to be able to say, look, we've been concentrating on bread and butter issues. The DUP and Sinn Féin have been focused on this political drama. And I think really there's going to be an expectation for Geoffrey to show that, or the DUP really to show that they can address those issues, I would say, within that constituency. But I'd say for his electorate, I think for Geoffrey Donaldson, you know, there's a lot of anger about the protocol at this point in time, and I think that's going to be something the DUP are going to be expected to deliver on, and also this language legislation, which you know, they've obviously, there's been some objections to, but there's maybe some hope that when Geoffrey comes in, there might be more people around him which might be more willing to compromise and go back to what was agreed last year.
Well, on the Irish Language Act, because that's more immediate, I suppose. If Geoffrey Donaldson mm-hmm. becomes the new leader of the DUP, then the process perhaps of First Minister. Just go back on that again. Will Paul Given, do you believe, stay in place for a time or not?
I think he will be there for a wee while, and then it looks like he's going to be asked to step down. And then they're going to have to, DUP then is going to have to renominate somebody else to be First Minister. That's what Suzanne Breen in the Belfast Telegraph is saying this morning.
And so what will Geoffrey Donaldson do in that interim around the Irish language? Is there anything that he can do on that? Because the British government has given mm-hmm. its commitment now to move on this if the Assembly doesn't.
I think there will be pressure put on the British government in respect to the protocol. And I think that may be tied into the language legislation. I do think that the DUP are probably going to use this opportunity to get a bit of leverage out of the British government. I think there's a lot of anger that they were seen to go over the heads of the unionists and make this offer around the language legislation. Though obviously you could counter that and say, well, the British government just said, well, this was agreed last year. But I think the DUP are going to use this opportunity to you know, say what they would like to show the government that they cannot be, in their minds, they can't be run over, and, you know, show that they're there, and then they're also a partner in government.
But what stance could he possibly get on the protocol that would have credibility among the electorate, given that the protocol issue mm-hmm. is way above the heads of the DUP? This is a matter between the European Commission and the British government, the UK government.
Yes, well, exactly, you know, and I think that's for a lot of, you know, a lot of unionists are quite pragmatic about the protocol, who you wouldn't think of from some of the coverage. That is the question, you know, the UK government while there seems to be a lot of talk about amending it or taking steps to, you know, to mitigate it, the UK government isn't willing to take the steps really it should be taking, in my opinion. So there is a question here about what concessions can the DUP get out of the UK government. But I do think it's probably going to be for them I think, you know, it's going to be an opportunity for them to show that they're going to take a stand, that they're going to maybe try and see if they can. There's this idea that really the Boris Johnson does not want Stormont to collapse at all during the EU negotiations at this point. So I think, as I said, I think ideally there's some people within their electorate that want the protocol to be dumped completely, but that's just unrealistic. It's not going to happen.
And just briefly, Sarah, do you expect an election sooner than next May?
Oh, that's always a good question. I would say yes at this point, with the caveat that obviously, you know, we maybe could have this could obviously go well, and maybe the DUP could get in, and maybe we will go to next year. But I think at this point, with all the wrangling, the political wrangling, I could see possibly an election coming, because obviously if the DUP do not nominate for First Minister, or if Sinn Féin don't nominate again, if maybe something happens with the language legislation, there's a 7-day period, and then the Secretary of State has to call an election. So that could happen.
Lovely. Well, good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed, Sarah Crichton, their writer and commentator, joining us from Belfast.
Build 40,000 homes a year and retain the $4 billion pumped into health during the pandemic. Fine Gael promises are aspirations. Leo Varadkar set out his stall to the party Ardhesh at the weekend, and he told the This Week programme that it's Fine Gael policy, and very often Fine Gael policy becomes government policy. But how's he paying for it, and can this country afford the Varadkar plan? Remember, at the start of the year, he predicted the economy would take off like a rocket after the pandemic. Sebastian Barnes is the chair of the Independent Irish Fiscal Advisory Council, which has warned the government about painting too rosy a picture of future tax revenue and underestimating the likely decline in corporation tax receipts. Sebastian Barnes, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, I know you don't comment on party policies and so on, but if this government is to increase in their housing plan to 40,000 homes being built a year, and if they are to retain the $4 billion pumped into health during the pandemic and bring about changes as well to income tax, can this country afford that?
So I think the big question is really for politicians to explain how they would afford that. If you basically take the cost of providing today's government services, if you take that forward, and if you build in the big increase in capital spending in the National Development Plan, you get to a position by 2025 where basically the budget is at about the right level that would be required to bring debt down to a more prudent level. We're obviously going to come out of the crisis with a very high level of debt. Now, what that means is that any additional spending beyond those plans, for example, on housing or health, is going to have to be funded by some new source of funding. That's either going to have to be taxation, or it's going to be finding savings elsewhere on the spending side. And that's really what the politicians need to explain. Yes, we can afford to improve healthcare, we can afford to improve housing, but we need to have a plan that shows how we're going to pay for it. And at the same time, there are also potentially massive costs on the line related to climate change.
But the some of those massive costs were addressed by the Taoiseach yesterday in relation to things like climate change or MICA or other elements that are going to come into play. As he said, they will happen over a number of years. They will not all happen together this year. And he suggested that we can pay for health and we can pay for the investment in housing through growth and as well the winding down now of all the pandemic payments.
Well, the winding down of the pandemic payments and the recovery in tax revenue are all going to help, but that's really factored into the assessment I've just given you. And we're very used to what we've seen over the past few years is that growth and actually surges of corporation tax did pay for a lot of things. But the difficulty this time is, on the one hand, we're going to see corporation tax receipts under pressure because of the international tax reforms, but also the government last autumn made a very big package. It committed $5.4 billion in additional spending not related to COVID. And that money has essentially pre-committed what we would have had for growth over the next couple of years. So there really is no room left to pay for things with growth. Any additional spending has to be paid through taxation or reductions in spending elsewhere.
But are you right, Sebastian Barnes? Is the Fiscal Advisory Council right? Because Leo Varadkar said yesterday on the This Week programme, you have been wrong in the past. Let's just have a listen to what he said to Justin McCarthy.
They're not right in everything, you know. Bear in mind, this is the same fiscal council that told us that we wouldn't balance the budget, and we did it three times. And this is the same fiscal council that told us the economy was overheating when actually we were heading into Brexit, a pandemic and a big recession. So we'll take on board their advice, but they are often wrong.
Sebastian Barnes, do you want to respond to what the Taoiseach was saying there?
So I think it's important. The council is an official body. It has is an independent body. It has a mandate to assess the public finances and the economy. We take that extremely seriously. And I think our reports, I stand really very much by the analysis that we've done. There was a recent review by the OECD that really showed that the council is essentially doing a good job, which is reassuring. And I think the difficulty is that politicians aren't always going to like the message that they hear from the council, because we're saying they actually have to make some pretty hard, difficult choices. I don't think anyone would particularly want to be in their shoes. But I think it's also a mistake for them to shoot the messenger just because they don't like the message.
Can I come back to what you were saying about international tax reforms and the wind down we're going to see in the tax take from corporation taxes? And you saw what happened at the G7 as well. How big is that cut going to be?
So it's very hard to know how big that cut is going to be. It depends what's going to happen at the G7, at the international level, G20. It depends what's going to happen in the US Congress, which is a very big player in this. And also, these tax receipts are really coming from a handful of big companies. Very detailed decisions about what happens politically or how they decide to respond could have a big impact. So the bottom line is we don't really know. But the government has put in a $2 billion reduction. We think it may be a little bit higher, or at least prudent. It would be prudent to factor in a bit more of a reduction, maybe $3.5 billion. It might not happen straight away. It might happen over a period of years. It might happen suddenly in a couple of years' time. But I think we do have to be planning for that and adjusting for it. And one of the council's pieces of advice is really that in the short run, some of that money should be put into the rainy day fund so that spending is gradually weaned off its overreliance on corporation tax.
You mentioned, I asked you about income tax and the marginal tax rate. Can we also cut that? Leo Varadkar also saying, I think it's the fourth highest rate in Europe.
So on the tax side, we said if there is there seems to be a strong desire to invest more in housing, to spend more on healthcare, also on the climate change side, it seems likely that taxes are going to have to increase in some form overall. Now, exactly how you do that is a different question. The government has put in place a tax commission. Hopefully, they're going to look at these sorts of questions. It's obviously very important that the tax system is efficient. It's very important that it's fair. And so these decisions are going to have to be taken in the years ahead.
So are you talking there about indirect taxation, transactional taxes, as opposed to personal taxation?
Well, one of the difficulties is that the government in the programme of government basically committed not to increase about a third of the overall tax base. They talked a little bit about PRSI and one or two other taxes that don't really bring in that much additional revenue. So there's a big question about how the government is going to address this in a fair way. And, you know, if you look at Ireland's position internationally again, the Irish tax take as a share of national income is somewhere around the EU average, perhaps a little bit higher. It's probably lower than in other higher income countries. And of course, what's made the big difference is that Ireland has been drawing in an unusually large amount of income through corporation tax, far more than most other countries have relative to the size of the economy. Now, as that comes under pressure, there's a big question facing the country really about whether it's going to be sort of going to have better public services and maybe higher taxes, or whether it's going to keep the current tax level or reduce it. But of course, that the implication of that is there's going to be less by way of public services.
For now, Sebastian Barnes of the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council, thank you for joining us.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. For more on our 212 offers, visit your local Kia dealer or log on to kia.com.
Now, Darren Frahill, good morning. I don't know, are you among the golf fans having a late night or an early morning?
Mary, I gave it a fairly good stab, but once Rory started going off kilter, I decided to call it a night. But what an incredibly busy morning it is in the world of sport. And we're going to start with that overnight news. John Rahm winning the US Open on a phenomenal night at Torrey Pines. He finished with back-to-back birdies to end the event on 6 under par. Rory McIlroy, as I said, his challenge faded late on, but he was right in the mix. Greg Allen has all the details.
It was a final day with a glittering cast of challengers. Four of the world's top five players all closed to within at least 3 shots of the lead at one stage or another. And the world number 11, Rory McIlroy, closed within a single stroke. But they weren't just battling against a man on a mission. They were battling karma. Well, that's how John Rahm saw it. Just 16 days ago, the 26-year-old Spaniard had to leave the course after the third round of the Memorial event in Ohio when he had a six-shot lead. Now, a win seemed inevitable, but a COVID diagnosis saw him whisked abruptly off to an isolation room and he played no further part in the tournament. He only came out of quarantine 6 days ago, but he steadily built up his challenge over the 4 days and it really caught fire with birdies in his first two holes in yesterday's final round. But more significant were his birdies on the 17th and 18th with two putts of at least 15 feet going to ground, and that took him to a one-shot victory on 6 under par over South African Louis Westhuizen after a final round of 67.
It almost feels like this is a movie that's about to end and I'm going to wake up soon. But with the setback I had a couple weeks ago to end up like this, it's incredible. I do love Torrey Pines and Torrey Pines loves me.
Many of the world's top players had their chances. No one better than defending champion Bryson DeChambeau, who dropped four shots and three holes in the back nine, while McIlroy was tied for second place when he encountered his own crisis, dropping three shots on 11 and 12, and he never challenged for the title after that, shooting a 73 to finish tied for seventh place on one under.
You know, I have to take the positives from this week. Yes, it's disappointing that I had a chance and didn't get the job done, but considering where I've been the previous few majors, it's a big step in the right direction.
Ireland's other challenger in the final round, Shane Lowry, couldn't find any inspiration, shooting a 79 to finish on 13 over par.
Yeah, Greg Allen there. I'm afraid Leona Maguire just came up short in her bid to win on the LPGA Tour for the first time. She finished 23 under par and in second place at the Meyer Classic, just two shots behind the winner, Kelly Korda. The Irish Rugby Sevens team made history by beating France at the World Rugby Sevens event in Monaco, and they have qualified for the Olympics. They trailed at the break, but they came from behind to win it 28-19 and have booked their ticket to the Games. We'll hear from their squad a little bit later on the show. Now, Kilkenny beat Galway to claim the Littlewoods Division 1 Camogie title at Croke Park. It took place last night and was part of an official trial welcoming fans back to the major sporting events in this country. Porrick Lodge went along for us.
Roger.
Aoife Flanagan, Kilkenny, Camogie Pierro. Well, it's great excitement in Croke Park last December for the All-Ireland with no fans. It was completely different. So it's great to see and to look over here from the Hogan Stand over to the Cusick Stand. It's immense to see people sitting out in the sun and enjoying it and looking forward to a great league final.
And the referee blows the full-time whistle. Kilkenny are the Littlewoods Ireland's league champions 2021.
With Denise Gall, you've claimed the league title in front of a crowd on Croke Park. What was it like to have the fans back here this evening?
Ah, yeah, sure. It was brilliant, I suppose. Great support and a good match for him to watch, hopefully. But, yeah, no, it was brilliant, I suppose, seeing the family and all after the match, getting to go over to see him. It was brilliant to have him back, so hopefully for championship they'll be allowed in as well.
What do you think swung the game your way in the end?
I don't know. I think we just come out probably the first 15 minutes, second half, and we just worked like dogs out there and turned over a lot of ball and got a few scores, and probably the goal, I suppose, kind of put us a few points up, and it was kind of tick for tack after that, but we had a few points ahead, so it probably kept us ahead, I suppose.
While the late Sunday fixture divided opinion, the Camogie Association president Hilda Breslin felt it was a valuable opportunity to showcase the sport.
The late throw-in came before we knew there was any attendance, and that's the reality. It's a prime time slot on RTE. You know, we can't refuse those sort of things. We were coming in after the soccer. We were thrilled to be in Croke Park at 7:30 on the national broadcaster. We can't ask for more than that. The crowds were coming back in. You know, I think the girls said it this week when they were asked about the late throw-in. They always knew this was the time. They would have played it at any time, day or night. They just want to play in Croke Park, on TV, in front of all of these people. So I didn't see it, I suppose, the same way as other people saw it. I know maybe people are up tomorrow and it's a long day, but you know, you get two outings in Croke Park and sometimes, and twice a year to make it late night in Croke Park's not an awful lot.
The weekend events at Croke Park have been deemed a success by the stadium's head of operations, Tony McGuinness.
Yeah, fantastic 2 days, Park. We had a couple of thousand in yesterday and another thousand in today for the Camogie finals. Great atmosphere around the place and great to see people back in the stadium. We've been working on this for the last 15 months, to be honest, and we've had a few false dawns along the way, and we would have been looking to get back at some stage last year and later on. So we haven't had spectators in the stadium since the last Camogie club games back in March last year. So we've been working on plans during all that time, and really now they've come to fruition the last couple of days, and hopefully we can look forward to some bigger attendances down the road.
Yeah, let's hope Tony McGuinness is right there. Tony, finishing up that report from Pádraig Lodge. Finally, Italy beat Wales 1-0 at the Euro. Switzerland got the better of Turkey, but it's Italy who topped the standings there in Group A, and Wales will take the second automatic qualifying spot on goal difference.
Brazil has become the second country after the United States to surpass 500,000 COVID-19 deaths as the South American country grapples with a third wave of the pandemic. Flavia Machadou, she's Professor of Critical Care and Chief of the Intensive Care Sector at the Federal University Hospital in Sao Paulo, has been telling our reporter Ailee Sheehy that the situation won't improve until many more people are vaccinated.
Now we have 55 ICU beds exclusively for COVID, and they are all full. All days we are admitting new patients and discharging patients, and of course also losing patients.
Is there any shortage of medical supplies at your hospital at present?
Yes, it is not as bad as it was on March and April, where we run out of sedatives and neuromuscular blockades in many hospitals all around Brazil. But we are still having problems with supplies. It's two sorts of problems. One sort is not finding the supplies to buy. So we are now in Brazil lacking everywhere an antibiotic, which is very important for this MDR patient with this polymyxin. We cannot buy polymyxin in Brazil. And it is very hard sometimes to buy sedatives and neuromuscular blockage. And the prices are very high. The companies are taxing too much. And we at the public hospitals, we are facing a lot of financial problems because the prices are so high, and the money that the government give us to take care of these patients, it's not increasing as the prices had increased.
Are the patients you're treating in ICU for COVID-19, are they vaccinated or unvaccinated?
It is a mix at this moment. They're starting to vaccinate people in the age of 55. So there's a lot of people not vaccinated yet. And it is also true that we are having vaccinated people in our ICUs, but they are not healthy. So the immune system sometimes did not respond to vaccines as the healthy people. So unfortunately, yes, we are having vaccinated people in the ICUs.
And what's the age profile of those patients you're treating in ICU?
It's also a mix. We are admitting young people now because they are not vaccinated. But we are always admitting elderly people, both vaccinated and not vaccinated. Unfortunately, there is a campaign in Brazil against vaccine, as you might know. So many people, they are still not vaccinating themselves. So we're still having a lot of elderly people that have the right to vaccinate themselves, and they are refusing this.
And Flavia, why is Brazil now being hit by a third wave?
I wouldn't call it a third wave. COVID never left the Brazilian ICUs. We are having COVID ICUs for a year and a half now. So what we call this, not a wave, but I would say a worsening of our steady state. What we have in March and April, we used to call it a tsunami because it's not a wave, as I said. But I think that now it's getting worse again. We are in a bad plateau because we have late vaccination. As everybody knows, our government, our president, they have postponed the acquisition of vaccines. So now we are actually getting the people vaccinated. And our president, it's against the social isolation. He's against using masks. So there's a lot of political influence on this.
And that was Flavia Machado, who is Professor of Critical Care and Chief of the Intensive Care Sector at Federal University Hospital of Sao Paulo in Brazil, talking to Ailee Sheehy. Well, July the 19th is fast approaching, the date when international travel will resume, we are told. But the Chief Medical Officer has said only those who are fully vaccinated should be allowed to travel. The Taoiseach, meanwhile, says young people who will not be vaccinated for another while yet should be allowed too, as long as they have negative PCR tests. The worry is the Delta variant and bringing it back in increasing numbers to these shores. We are joined now by Ulton Power, who is Professor of Molecular Biology at Queen's University. Professor Power, thanks for joining us this morning. The numbers fully vaccinated by around the middle of July could be as low as 40%. It's hard to say at this point. On that basis, should international travel be restricted to those only who are fully vaccinated?
My own personal feeling at the moment, Audrey, is that there's still large swathes of the globe that are not vaccinated, or still the numbers of vaccines have been distributed at a very, very low level. And this means that there's going to be the possibility of new variants. Currently, we're talking about the Delta variant, but, you know, there's going to be other variants that are going to come along. And what we've seen over the last year or so is that every new variant that we get appears to be stronger in terms of its capacity to transmit and, in many cases, cause increased levels of hospitalizations compared to the previous variants that were circulating. So if we continue to travel, and especially those that are non-vaccinated continue to travel, we continue to increase that risk of people bringing those viruses back onto the island. And at the moment, for this year, I think, while we're still rolling out the vaccines, I think my recommendation certainly would be that we should minimize the level of travel, international travel we have, to an as-needs basis.
But even people who are fully vaccinated, it's not known at this point if transmission is prevented. So you could be fully vaccinated, but bringing it back with you and transmitting it.
This is the concern. We know from data from Israel, to some studies that have been done in the UK, that the vaccines are, especially two doses of the vaccines, can diminish the level of transmission substantially, obviously compared to people who are unvaccinated. But, and most importantly, even against the Delta variant, there's a significant reduction in hospitalization, or a huge reduction in hospitalizations for individuals who are fully vaccinated. So that is happening. There is a diminish, but it does not eliminate the risk. And this is the point at the moment, is that if we have, like, say, for example, 70% efficacy in terms of preventing transmission of the disease, there's still like the upwards of 30% of people who will end up being, you know, getting infected and being able to transmit the virus. And we know already of individuals and individual circumstances where people have been fully vaccinated. In fact, you just heard it there from Brazil, people who have been vaccinated and who are still ending up in hospital. So we have to be very, very careful and very vigilant, like, in the next few months, to make sure that we roll out the vaccination as much as possible.
But if we are waiting for the risks to be fully eliminated, we could be waiting a very long time, because even if the Delta variant eventually gets under control, there could be another variant.
There will undoubtedly be another variant. And in fact, I'm just beginning to hear echoes of one coming from Africa at the moment. So they, again, you know, there will be other variants, there's no doubt about that. This is what these viruses do. But the big key thing, Audrey, is the vaccination levels, both within Ireland, within the UK, Europe, but globally. And as in, we know that there are a bunch of countries that still haven't really any significant vaccination happening yet. So this is the concern, is a global vaccination needs to be rolled out as rapidly as possible.
So the CMO here, Tony Houlihan, saying only fully vaccinated people, the Taoiseach is saying young people, because they have been denied so much for so much longer than perhaps everybody else, they should be allowed to travel as long as they have negative PCR tests. That conflicting advice, I mean, it's not useful, is it, for the public trying to make decisions?
Again, from purely from a virological point of view, I would be very much inclined to agree with the CMO that, you know, young people can be infected, although they don't have the same severity or the frequency of severe disease as older people do. They still can surely be infected and they can easily transmit the virus. So if we want to minimize the risks to all of us, then we need to take this very, very seriously, especially a variant. If we end up with a variant, you know, the Delta variant is already very, very serious in terms of its capacity to be able to transmit easier than the previous variants we've had. If we get a new variant that's even worse, again, we increase the risks and the restrictions that the whole of the country will suffer because of it. So this is okay. why I would be inclined to follow the advice of the CMO at this stage.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Ulton Power, Professor of Molecular Biology at Queen's University.
Ireland's data regulation regime was the main driver of tech multinational investment here, according to a survey by law firm William Fry. It replaces tax, which topped the same survey when it was last conducted in 2016. That factor is now ranked 8th behind the likes of access to talent and the country's legal framework. John O'Connor is partner in William Fry's technology department and he joins me now. John, what exactly is it that's drawing companies in terms of data regulation? Is Ireland seen maybe to have a lighter touch regime than other countries?
No, I don't think so. What's coming across in our report, Adam, is that Ireland's regulatory approach, not just in relation to data protection, but financial services too, and other regulated sectors, is that it's a firm but fair regulatory approach. And I think organizations are gravitating much more to consistent and predictable regulation, as well as political stability, as well as Ireland's common law system. So aspects like that, I think, are coming to the fore.
Now, last week, the European Court of Justice ruled that national watchdogs will be able to pursue tech firms for regulatory breaches, even if they're headquartered in Ireland and the data is based in Ireland. Do you think that's going to impact the attractiveness for data investments?
I don't think so in a significant way. The decision was really about that if issues play out in a particular domestic member state other than Ireland, and they're not really pan-European issues that involve multiple member states, then the relevant regulator, say, in Belgium, would be able to carry out that investigation, which seems actually quite logical in practice. But when aspects are then pan-European, it would be the lead regulator for that organisation. If that lead regulator happened to be the Data Protection Commission, then it would be done there. Equally, the decision said that the local regulator in the likes of Belgium would have to consult with the likes of the Data Protection Commission here in Ireland if the lead regulator for, let's say, the likes of Facebook was in fact the Data Protection Commission. So I don't think that's going to negatively impact upon Ireland's attractiveness.
Now, as I mentioned earlier, data replaces tax as the top motivator. That's fallen to 8th now. Has our low rate already lost its appeal because companies know what's coming down the tracks in terms of a global minimum rate?
No, not really. I think what's really happened in the last maybe 10 years, and certainly more quickly in the last 5 years, is that multinationals are looking at a multitude of factors when deciding to invest or establish operations in a particular region. And those factors are consistent regulation and predictable regulation, the legal system, political stability, the availability of talent, educated workforce, English speaking comes to the fore, particularly for Ireland, and tax obviously is a factor. But I think it was such a dominant factor for many years in terms of, you know, inward investment. It's no longer as dominant. It's one of the factors that is taken into consideration. And in our findings, it actually came 8th in a list of important factors that drive those decisions.
John O'Connor, partner in William Fry's technology department, thank you very much.
Housing for All, a new government plan to be announced next month, gets a preview in the Irish Examiner's lead story. Daniel McConnell reports that it will give elderly people incentives to downsize, remove height caps in cities, and bring 90,000 vacant units into use. The plan, he says, aims to deliver 33,000 homes a year by 2025. Everything is on the table, a senior government source told the paper, saying there was a concerted effort finally to get to grips with this. Leave it out, says the lead headline in the Irish Daily Star. The paper reports that pubs are in turmoil again, as Gardaí say outdoor pints could be illegal. Similarly, the Irish Daily Mail headline speaks of a Garda blow for outdoor summer. Pub and restaurant owners have been left infuriated by a glaring government oversight that means it is illegal to serve alcohol in new outdoor seating areas, the paper says. On the other hand, the Irish Daily Mirror in its lead story reports that Taoiseach Leo Varadkar as saying yesterday that people who are not vaccinated can still holiday abroad this summer. He added that the government differs from the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Houlihan, on this question. This difference of opinion is considered in the Irish Independent's lead story. The paper reports that what it calls a worrying reluctance to take the COVID-19 vaccine among a sizable minority of young people and conflicting official advice about summer travel is compounding the challenges to defeat the virus. A third factor, the Independent says, is the worrying spike in infections with the Delta variant of COVID in many European countries. The Irish Times leads with a report that the government is set to make renewed efforts to explore the acquisition of lands where the new National Maternity Hospital is to be built. Well-placed sources said that the state would engage with St Vincent's Hospital Group and the Religious Sisters of Charity, which owns the land in Dublin 4. Senior government sources, possibly the same ones, believe that the matter should be resolved soon. Two documentary series about the killing of Sophie Tuscon du Plantier in West Cork in 1996, one of which was released yesterday, get different treatment in different papers. Dan Linehan's photograph on the Examiner's front page shows a smiling Ian Bailey at the farmer's market in Skull yesterday. Mr. Bailey was found guilty of the murder when tried in absentia by a court in Paris, but has always maintained his innocence, as Greg Murphy reports. And he has said he probably won't see the Sky series about the death of the French filmmaker because he does not receive that channel. In a review in The Independent, Pat Stacey says the director, Jim Sheridan, sometimes pushes the series to the edge of gothic overload, but the tone is one of sadness for a life viciously cut short. He notes that the victim's parents and her son had requested that their contribution to the documentary be removed because of how, as they see it, the series portrays Ian Bailey. For his part, Mr. Bailey is highly critical of the Netflix series, which airs on the 30th of this month, so Barry Roach reports in The Times.
John, thank you. Let's join our crime correspondent.
We're returning to our main story this morning, and confusion reigns over the legality of serving and consuming drink in the outdoor spaces that have been developed outside pubs and restaurants to enable people to enjoy an outdoor summer. Gardaí say that the consumption of alcohol in these spaces is not permitted unless specifically provided for in a liquor licence obtained in court or where bylaws permit the drinking of alcohol in public. Publicans in Galway were warned by Gardaí last week about outdoor drinking. The Minister for Justice, Heather Humphrey, said on Twitter yesterday, Gardaí will engage with licensed premises and will use their discretion, as they've done throughout COVID. Now, in a moment, we'll hear from the Garda Representative Association, but first, let's hear from Páirc Cribben, who's Chief Executive of the Vintners Federation of Ireland. Are you and your members, Páirc Cribben, confused now about what the law is or the law is not around the serving of alcohol in these outdoor spaces?
Good morning, Mary. I suppose the first thing to say is that both the public and the publicans have been advised now for months to prepare for an outdoor summer. Not alone that, but both the government and local authorities have put in place facilities by way of seating, etc., and closing off streets, and the government by way of grants to facilitate that. We believe that that the Gardaí in a lot of areas are using their discretion, but 10 days ago I wrote to the Department of Justice spelling out that this discretion was not being administered evenly. The Department of Justice themselves on the 28th of May issued, I suppose, what could be called guidelines, and they updated them on the 9th of June. And any reasonable person reading those guidelines would suggest there shouldn't be a problem. But I saw a problem 10 days ago in certain areas, and I wrote to the Department of Justice asking that they would bring clarity to the situation by way of using the emergency legislation that is there to ensure that both the Section 254 outdoor seating areas and the areas provided by the councils right around the country, that there would be no ambiguity and that there would be the possibility to serve both food and drink in those areas.
So, Páirc, you were aware of at least an ambiguity here. What happened 10 days ago?
10 days ago, it became clear to me that there were some areas where Gardaí might have had a different view. I mean, our view is quite simple, is that if you were in these what is called a Section 254 area, there shouldn't be an issue.
Explain that to us, will you, a Section 254?
If you apply to the council for an outdoor seating area in a public, on the street, let's put it that
yes.
way, you apply for that under Section 254 of the Planning Act. It's simply referred to as a Section 254 license. So if you see outside a pub or outside a cafe, you see somebody sitting out eating or having a snack there, you can assume that they're sitting in what's referred to as a Section 254.
And to cut to the chase on that, if you have a Section 254, are you the publican legally permitted then to serve alcohol to somebody sitting there?
Yes, we believe so. Absolutely.
You believe so, or you know so?
Sorry?
You believe so or you know so as a legal fact?
That is the legal situation.
Okay.
But also, Gardaí have been using, it's sometimes difficult to find out what different Gardaí are using, but there is a situation where you cannot sell alcohol for consumption within 100 metres of your premises. But if you look very closely at the wording of Section 17.2 of the 2003 Act, it says you cannot sell for consumption within 100 metres of your premises if the product is in, and there's four very important words, in a closed container. No publican sells in a closed container. The closed container comes from off licences. So there is confusion. We recognise that confusion, or the possibility for that confusion, 10 days ago. And that's why I asked
the Department
of Justice to bring forward a statutory instrument to cover this for the coming 3 to 4 months.
All right, which is what Adrian Cummins from the Restaurant Association told us he is looking for as well from the Departments of Health and Justice. You still have some confusion about it. Brendan O'Connor is the Vice President of the Garda Representative Association. And Brendan, thank you for joining us as well. Heather Humphreys has said that your members will use their discretion. But is there confusion among Garda Síochána members about what the laws are, from bylaws to licensing laws?
There is absolute confusion because, as your previous speaker outlined, there are so many different pieces of legislation and statute, and it's individual Gardaí and the members we represent that will be sent out to try and police this. And while the minister is referring to discretion and common sense, which is something that guards would traditionally have always applied, in recent times the message is coming to our members loud and clear from our winner own organisation that if you observe any breach of the law, there has to be someone made amenable, and our members are facing discipline and other issues in relation to it. So also another factor that's arising is I think people are talking about this in the context of maybe the cafe culture that we visit, people sitting having a civilised glass of wine with a meal, and that's fair enough, that won't be a police requirement. But what our members will often get called to at late night or late in the evening is people who have consumed a lot of alcohol, maybe a complaint from a neighbour in relation to 254 licence, maybe a complaint from another business premises that someone has exceeded the number of tables. We have, the bylaws introduced by councils, or someone might make a complaint about a public safety concern. So who will be there to make a decision is our members, two guards maybe on a patrol car covering up to maybe 5 or 6 sub-districts, and who will be held accountable in 6 or 7 months' time, sitting across the table from a senior officer or from a person in GSOC saying, what did you do? There was a breach of the law here. So that's all we're looking for, is clear guidelines that our members won't be scapegoated and held accountable and for impossible decisions that have to be made when the policymakers have moved on to something else, and our members are the people who are picking up the pieces and are on the ground making decisions, as I said, in a very difficult and policing environment.
In the meantime, your members are out day after day now because these outdoor spaces are in operation. What is happening? What's going to happen today, tomorrow, coming up to next weekend?
Well, I suppose at the moment what's happened is people are gathering evidence, maybe talking to people, trying to research it, trying to get a handle on the legislation. But that's where we're looking for leadership, guidance from our own organisation, say what is expected of us. Because another problem that arises is the public are given these mixed messages from different sources and policymakers and comments and even statements from our own organisation. And, we just sometimes we don't know what is expected. And the public are given an expectation of what they will see. And again, the members that I represent are the people who will see action, and there will be allegations of inaction in some cases, and there will be allegations of overzealous police. Mm. It's an absolute minefield for our members.
So, Brendan, are you saying you're not accepting discretion as a rule of thumb by which Gardaí are going to live by when they're trying to police these new laws?
Well, look, discretion is something that has to apply, and our members are very adept and have used discretion since the foundation of the state. But the whole conversation about discretion has moved into a different place because of different reports and different policies that are telling our members that if you exercise discretion in some circumstances, that it's ranging in everything from incompetence to discipline to wrongdoing. So we need guidance on what exactly is expected. The old situation of sending guards out that are untrained and ill-equipped to say, sure, do your best and see what you can do. And then when things go wrong, it's when things go wrong that our members are left very vulnerable and very isolated, answering questions with their actions and what they did and their decision-making.
And Padraig Cribben, Adrian Cummins was talking earlier as well about the massive spend there's been on preparing for this outdoor summer, some 17 million. You want this statutory instrument as well. Will you be getting in touch with the Ministers for Health and Justice, or have you already done so?
As I said, Mary, I did that 10 days ago.
But nothing happened.
But what is very evident from your other contributor is what we're looking at here is a minister talking about Gardaí using discretion, a directive from the commissioner not to use discretion. And what we're seeing being played out is tensions between justice and the Gardaí, and indeed very possibly tensions within the Gardaí, because it's obvious that the Gardaí on the ground are being left to a certain extent in no man's land. And I think that's where both policy and direction needs to come. And it needs to come fast because, you know, there are areas in the country where people are, where my members are concerned that they're doing everything in line with the guidance from the Department of Justice on the 28th of May, updated on the 9th of June, but they're getting a different vibe from the Gardaí on the ground, and that's okay. Not good enough.
Well, thank you both very much for joining us this morning. That's Brendan O'Connor of the GRA and Padraig Cribben of the Vintners Federation of Ireland.
Let's talk now about the ownership of the new National Maternity Hospital. The site at St Vincent's Hospital in Dublin is owned by a religious order of nuns, and they plan to gift it to a new body that will run the hospital. But there are growing concerns among government around ownership and governance of the hospital, and as well as opposition politicians and others. And these concerns extend to worries over whether a religious ethos will govern medicine there. We are joined now by Sinn Féin's health spokesman, David Cullinan. David Cullinan, you're welcome to the programme. Why, in your view, does the state have to own this land?
Well, first of all, Audrey, I want to see this new National Maternity Hospital built as quickly as possible. It's already 6 years behind schedule. The costs have escalated over the last number of years from an estimated cost of 300 million originally to now up to 800 million euro. So obviously the focus has to be on building the hospital as quickly as possible. And listen, for a long number of years, there has been very real concerns in relation to the ownership of the site and governance issues. I think everybody would accept that we don't want to see any religious ethos or interference in the running of any hospital, but especially the National Maternity Hospital. And it's very important that we get the structures and the foundations right. And I think we need to look at all of the options. We've heard over the last number of days from the Taoiseach and from the Tánaiste and from the Minister for Health that they accept that there are issues in relation to the ownership of the site, that there are issues in relation to governance, but they have to be engaging very extensively with the religious Sisters of Charity and the St. Vincent's Healthcare Group to find a solution, because, as I said, we want the hospital built as quickly as possible. We don't want delays.
And both of those bodies, the religious orders and the St. Vincent's Hospital Group, they both said on Friday, I think, that they had never received an offer from the state. Were you surprised by that?
I was very surprised by that, and that's why I was taken aback by the comments by the Tánaiste when I and others raised this issue with him in the Dáil last week. If the Tánaiste and the Taoiseach and the Minister for Health are saying that they are aware and have been aware for some time that there are problems in relation to the ownership of the site. Well, why was this issue not discussed at the highest level with the Religious Sisters of Charity and the St. Vincent's Healthcare Group? I think the best option here, Audrey, would be for the Religious Sisters of Charity to gift the land to the state. They're essentially saying that that's been done anyway by the establishment of this independent private charity. I think it would be better if the hospital was built on public lands, where we had a public hospital built on public lands and governed by the state, because also this new charity will have an independent board of governors that won't be appointed by the minister. And I think that does raise very serious issues. So the best way around this would be for very extensive engagements now between the Minister for Health and the Religious Order and indeed the St. Vincent Group, and try and get the land into public ownership. And I think the best and less costly way to do that, obviously, would be for the Religious Sisters of Charity to simply gift the land to the state.
And if that agreement isn't reached, should the state use a compulsory purchase order to do it?
Well, I think that would have to be the last option. I think all options have to be on the table. The problem with that option is it would be lengthy. It would have to go through courts, I would imagine. It would delay the project even further. I know that the Taoiseach has talked about the state purchasing the site. The problem is, as you've already said, the Religious Sisters of Charity have said they haven't been contacted by the department or the government in relation to that issue. So that is troubling and concerning, and we don't need public pronouncements by the Minister for Health or indeed by the Taoiseach. We need them to be rolling up their sleeves, engaging with the stakeholders, find a solution, and at least ask the question in relation to the ownership. Because if the Religious Sisters of Charity are saying that in principle they have no option, they have no objection, I should say, of gifting the land to the state, and they say they are essentially doing this by setting up this independent charity, why not go a step further and simply gift the land entirely to the state, and that would resolve all of the issues?
And in terms of the Board of Governors, I understand that there will be four from the National Maternity Hospital, four appointed by the St. Vincent's Group, and one public interest. Is that sufficient, or do you think the state should have more representatives on the new governing board?
I think the state should have more representatives. I think the governance should be managed by the state. And as I said, I want a public national maternity hospital built on public land, owned by the state and governed by the state. And why have these kind of halfway measures of having an independent charity? It would be far better if the state, if the hospital was governed by the state and the minister was able to appoint people to the board. So obviously all of this has to be worked out, Audrey. The starting point has to be that the minister sits down and has very serious engagement with the stakeholders here. That is the St. Vincent's Group and the Religious Sisters of Charity. There's no point in megaphone diplomacy taking place here. We need a resolution of this as quickly as possible. And the last thing we need is to see more hold-ups in relation to this hospital, because as I said, the costs now are already estimated to be in the region of about 800 million and the original cost was 300 million. So every day, every week, every month, every year that this project is delayed, we're going to see escalating costs.
And just finally, are you wedded to that site? Because there's been some suggestion that if there's no agreement and if it can't be reached, perhaps the project should be pulled and another site else, somewhere else located.
Well, listen, the site was already selected, and it's not that whether I'm wedded to the site or not, it's whether or not an alternative site at this point in time would now delay the project for potentially years, which I think it would. Obviously, every option has to be on the table, but I think the best option here, and, you know, we have to look at, can we get the best case scenario or outcome here? And the best case scenario or outcome would be that the land is gifted to the state. So the starting point has to be for those negotiations now to take place as quickly as possible. Obviously, every option would need to be on the table, but I think the best option certainly would be to continue with this site, but try and get the site into public ownership, and that would deal with the governance issues and also ensure that the hospital is built as quickly as possible. And I can finally say as well, we also need to make sure that we have investment in other maternity hospitals. I know the Rotunda Hospital has raised very serious clinical concerns as well in relation to the investment which is necessary in their hospital to provide safe services. Well, we need to see the National Maternity Hospital built. We also have to make sure that the capital investment is also made in all of the maternity hospitals to ensure the very best maternity services for all women across the state.
Okay. Can I just ask you finally about the North? Because it's ongoing, the political turmoil there. If a new leader of the DUP demands a renegotiation of that deal that your party did with the Secretary of State last week over the Irish Language Act in order to nominate another First Minister, will you agree to that?
Well, first of all, we want power sharing to work. Audrey, we want the Assembly and the Executive to obviously demonstrate and to deal with all of the issues which need to be dealt with. So like in this state, obviously we need to focus on health and housing and those bread and butter issues. We also need to deal with those issues in the north. But there are legacy issues and issues that have previously been agreed to, such as Acna Gaeilge and other issues. I think that issue is dealt with. The British government will legislate for that, and for me that issue is now dealt with.
But if it means avoiding a collapse of the Assembly, of the Executive?
Well, I don't see that as an option at this point in time. Obviously, we will listen to and engage with the new leadership of the DUP, as we did with Edwin Poots, as we did with Arlene Foster. We want genuine power-sharing government. We will sit down and we will genuinely listen with and engage with the new leadership of the DUP. We want the Executive to work. We want the Executive to work in the interest of all of the people in the North. I think talk of collapsing the institutions at this point is irresponsible. What we need to do is sit around the table, deal with all of these issues and get on with the job of governing for the people, like the parties did during the pandemic. We need to bring that same level of vigour as well to bread and butter issues, which obviously people in the North want dealt with.
Thank you very much indeed, David Cullinan, Sinn Féin's health spokesman.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. For more on our 212 offers, visit your local Kia dealer or log on to kia.com.
It's 8:38 and it's all about the golf this morning, Darren.
It is. What an incredibly busy morning, Audrey, on the sporting front. And I think it might be a sign of things to come for the rest of the summer. Fingers crossed at the very least. Let's start with that overnight news. The golf. John Rahm, the US Open champion, after a dramatic night at Torrey Pines. Rory McIlroy's challenge faded late on. Greg Allen has all the details.
In what's been an already glittering five-year career, one of the few things missing in John Rahm's CV had been a major championship win, but he answered all the questions you could possibly think of yesterday in terms of nerve, skill and bravery, and then some. He was hugely impressive in a curious final round in which every single player with a chance of winning seemed to have a major crisis. And Rahm also appeared to have one too when his tee shot on the ninth hole went over a temporary fence, but a rules official deemed that it was not a boundary the course, and Rahm went on to make a very unlikely birdie there that sent him on his way to produce a grandstand finish with two near identical curling left to right birdie putts, each of around 15 feet on the 17th and 18th greens, which were greeted with an exclamation mark fist pump from the burly 26-year-old from the Basque Country, who only 2 weeks ago had to withdraw from holding a six-shot lead entering the final round of the Memorial Tournament due to a COVID diagnosis that actually left him in near tears, but he got a call from somebody and it made a difference.
The first person who called me that was in family was Padraig Harrington, and he told me a story in which he was leading by five after 54 holes, signed the wrong scorecard and got disqualified. And he said he got a lot more from that instance. He learned a lot more than he would have ever learned from a win. So I believed from the biggest setbacks you can get some of the biggest breakthroughs, and I felt it today out there on the golf course. I had in mind Padraig, and I knew today was my day.
Rahm's final round numbers yesterday added up to a brilliant 67 for a total of 6 under par and a one-stroke victory. Rory McIlroy had a really great chance on the final afternoon, and he was only 2 off the lead when he 3-putted the 11th and then went from bunker to bunker on the 12th for a double bogey. The momentum was lost and he shot a 73 for a 1 under par total, finishing in a share of 7th position.
I'll rue the 3-putt on 11, that sort of stopped the momentum. It was way better today. Look, the score doesn't suggest it. You know, there was 2 holes that really were the end of my title hopes. But apart from that, this week, it's been really positive.
McIlroy wasn't the only one to disappoint, as one by one, Colin Morikawa, Brooks Koepka and Bryson DeChambeau all made critical errors to recede down the leaderboard on the back nine, while Louis Westhuizen came up just one shot short for a 6th runner-up finish in a major championship, leaving Rahm the first Spanish winner of the US Open. For Shane Lowry, incidentally, a lackluster final day 79 saw him finish back on 13 over par.
Yeah, well done to John Rahm. And what a lovely touch from Padraig Harrington to call him after that disappointing news and playing a little part in that victory over the weekend. Leona Maguire, I'm afraid, just came up short in her bid to win on the LPGA Tour for the first time. She finished 23 under par, two behind the winner, Nelly Korda, at the Meyer Classic. The Irish Rugby Sevens team has made history by beating France at the World Event in Monaco to qualify for the Olympic Games. Despite trailing at the break, the Irish came from behind to win 28-19 in the final qualifying event for those games. The team skipper is Billy Dardis, and he's been doing his best to put this achievement into words when I spoke to him a short time ago.
Yeah, it's all been a bit of a blur. Like, I woke up there a few minutes ago and I'm still thinking, is Harry McNulty's try, is that a dream, seeing him run in and the lads going nuts? You don't really know how to describe what it feels like. Some of us are kind of like, feel like empty. Like, it's just words can't really describe it. So this morning I've mulled on it a little bit, and yeah, it's starting to sink in just how big of an achievement it is. Pretty cool to think that we've qualified for the Olympics, that we could be Olympians in the next four or five weeks.
It really is some story. There was only one place up for grabs. There was so much on the line, but you guys put in the performance of your lives. How did that come about?
We've played France so many times now, and we haven't beaten them now in 3 years. We're pretty nervous before the game. The warm-up wasn't the best warm-up in the world, but we actually perform as a team better when everyone's on edge, nervous, but aware of how big of a game this is. And we went out there and just went hammer and tongs at it. We obviously got lucky. We got a try pretty early on in the first few minutes, and then we had to defend for our lives. Those last 3-4 minutes were just... We started to believe that we could actually do it when we were right on their line, and then Harry gets that try, and lads just went nuts. So it's pretty cool. The performance, it's been building for years, though.
Billy, can I finish by asking you about your teammates? There's some pretty amazing backstories there. There's a reality TV star. He turned his back on the fame game. There's other guys who, you know, this was their opportunity to rekindle rugby careers. How unique is this group?
You wouldn't understand how unique of a group of lads we have. It's just sevens is funny. Like, it brings all people from all walks of life, and we're a weird, twisted, strange, odd group of lads that don't really fit. We are there's probably clashes left, right, and centre. But yeah, you've got Greg with Love Island. You've Jordo, who's played for Athlone Town. You've got Aaron Sexton, who's a sprint, like one of the fastest schoolboys of all time. And what's kind of common amongst us all is that we've all tasted a bit of devastation prior to winter sevens, because we all would have played in academies and would have had big aspirations of playing for our provinces and going on to play for Ireland. And a lot of us have kind of been told that, you're not going to do that, and we've been moved on. There's a bit of a chip on the shoulder mentality about that. That can really fog your mind if you're to channel that one way. But I think Anthony Eddy's done a pretty incredible job to channel it all together, and this group is so cool that anyone can fit in if you just be yourself.
I think a lesson for us all there. Kilkenny beat Galway by 3 points to claim the Littlewoods Division 1 Camogie title at Croke Park. It also marked a significant comeback for Katie Power. Pádraig Lodge has been speaking to her manager, Brian Dowling.
Brilliant to get Katie Power back on the pitch. I suppose we hadn't planned for it, but she went very well in the challenge game last Sunday with the intermediates and Tuesday night in training. And we just said coming up, we won't get her back onto this pitch for 10 minutes, no matter what way the game was going, because, Katie's been through absolute hardship the last 2 years with injuries. I don't think people would believe it if you explain what was going on. But just the work she's after putting in, and we just wanted to get her back onto this pitch, was great. And, she had a positive impact, which is brilliant. And look, we'll get another 4 tough weeks training to Katie now, and hopefully she'll be ready then for championship.
Any view on the late start? I know there was a lot of debate during the week about whether it was a good idea.
It's just a bit surprising now. Some of the girls, I suppose, have to work tomorrow. I'm okay, I'm a teacher, so I can have the morning off. But no, look, again, and I said straight away, it's to get to play in Croke Park is unbelievable, and thanks to the GAA and the Camogie for allowing that. To play out in this pitch is unbelievable. I've been involved in 2 league finals now, both of them have been here, and that's brilliant. To get to this is a stadium, this is where the game should be, and to get to play up here in the league final. Okay, it was on late in the evening, but look, we play here anytime. I said that last year, we'd play on Christmas Day if we had to, and the same this year, just to get up here to play, and I suppose it makes it extra special then when you get over the line and win.
Yeah, well done to them. Finally, Italy beat Wales 1-0 in the final round of games at the Euros. This is Group A. Switzerland got the better of Turkey, but it's Italy who topped the standings. Wales take the second automatic qualifying spot on goal difference. That is your sport for now.
Now, young people are more likely to suffer financial hardship when the pandemic unemployment payment comes to an end. Students will not be entitled to pre-existing unemployment supports when the payments wind down. And figures in April showed 34% of PUP recipients aged under 25 were registered as full-time students. In its latest report, the Economic and Social Research Institute also says that the income lost to households was more than halved as a result of the payments put in place. Dr. Claire Keane is a senior research officer with the ESRI. Good morning, Claire.
Good morning.
And tell us something more about the thrust of this piece of research you carried out.
Sure. So as you said there, we had a look to see what would have been the impact on people's incomes, people who were affected, jobs were affected by the pandemic, if the pandemic unemployment payment and the wage subsidies weren't introduced. So there would have been around a 7% loss in income, and that was reduced down to around 3% due to those payments. So as you highlighted there, we looked at what groups would be more negatively affected when those schemes wind down, who were more reliant on them. So you've identified students there as being a group that will not have an entitlement to the benefit come the pandemic unemployment payment come September. And there are some issues there around, you know, will there be the employment opportunities? Will they be back to normal? There are also some issues that we highlighted around the sort of grant rates and accessibility. So we know that students can get a means test and maintenance grant. However, if you look at the sort of rates of those grants, they're substantially below some sort of minimum income level if we think about unemployment supports as being around that level. So that was one group we identified. Outside of students, younger people in general, people under 25, are more reliant on the pandemic unemployment payment. And that's because if the job opportunities don't come back there, the benefit that they can get, job seekers allowance, the rate is significantly below that of PUP. Mm-hmm. And it's significantly below the rate that people over 25 can get. So, for example, a young person under 25 gets around €113 a week in the job seekers allowance compared to over 200 for somebody over 25.
I know you looked as well at, and there have been a lot of perhaps anecdotal stories about the payment, the pandemic unemployment payment, creating a lack of incentive for young people to get back to work. Did you find evidence of that?
We don't find much evidence that the pandemic unemployment payment has really weak work incentives. So before that scheme was introduced, around 1% of people were better off not working when you compare what they would get in benefits with what they get in employment. That rises to around 4% with the pandemic unemployment payment. But that still means over 95% of people are financially better off in work than on that payment. Now, of course, that assumes that they can get back to the sort of work hours that they were working before the pandemic. And that might be an issue. So if we think about the sort of sectors really affected, hotels, restaurants, there's probably a demand for sort of more flexibility around work hours in those sectors. So one feature of the pandemic unemployment payment that we highlight that might create a work disincentive is the fact that as soon as you take up even, you know, 1 hour of work, you lose the full payment. And that's unusual compared to the sort of other, you know, unemployment supports that are out there. At the moment, self-employed people can keep some of the payment, you know, and they can work as well before it's withdrawn. That's not the case for employees. So one sort of policy suggestion or suggestion for policymakers would be to allow people, young people in particular, but people in general, keep some of that pandemic unemployment payment as they go back to work, because they mightn't be getting back to the full hours that they were doing before the pandemic.
And does that policy suggestion extend then to students who are going to lose their pandemic unemployment payment on return to college in September? Are you arguing for some incentive in addition to their grants while those worries about employment opportunities continue?
Well, sure. So the pandemic unemployment payment is intended to keep it in place till the end of the year, but be withdrawn earlier for students. So it might be the case that we might want to wait and see, do those employment opportunities come back for students? So a survey even before the pandemic found a very high reliance by students on working, with over 50% of students saying they're missing lectures in order to work. And that's more where the sort of education supports, things like the maintenance grants, will be more important. So bringing them up to a level that can ensure that maybe students don't after work or work such high hours when they're studying would be useful.
All right. Dr. Claire Keane of the ESRI, thank you.
Now, I've been saying it all morning. It is the longest day of the year, the official start of summer. It's the summer solstice. So what does it all mean? We are joined now by Kevin Nolan, astronomer and lecturer in physics at TU, and by Julie Nivuelon, the Dingle Druid. Julie, you have a super title. I wish I had more time to talk to you about the Dingle Druid. But listen, you got up at dawn this morning. What was it like?
I did. I got up at dawn this morning. It was actually very dull, but yet it was still very beautiful. The point of the solstice was at 4:32, and there was an awful lot of cloud formations, and there was a lot of wind, so there was a lot of movement in the clouds. But it was still a beautiful dawning, because we are here at the time of celebrating the sun, our sun goddess Lu and Anna. And I suppose at this morning, with the clouds very much, I was feeling into when we are celebrating the sun, we're celebrating the male energy, the outward energy and action. And then when we celebrate the moon, we have the feminine energy, and our intuition and our inward life. So this morning, even though it was very dark, you know, during the time of, I suppose, how we outwardly portray ourselves to the world at this time of the year in solstice, you know, what our manifestations and what we've achieved in life, and that high energy of sun, the high energy of those poor students celebrating, and all of us who want to celebrate now, you know, the gathering of flowers and the bonfires, gathering around the bonfires. And traditionally in Ireland would be St. John's Eve, which is the 23rd, that would be the bonfire night, but okay. Also the bonfire would be the solstice.
Kevin, what is the science bit here? What happens on this day?
So basically the Earth actually is on a tilt of 23.5 degrees, and that tilt is constant, but as we move around the sun, our orientation changes. So right here in the Northern Hemisphere, we're tilted towards the sun, so we basically get more sunlight. And as I said, the sun rises very early at around 4:30 in the morning and won't set till after 9 this evening, so giving us around 16 or 17 hours. And then conversely, in winter, we're tilted away from the sun by 20 degrees and we get our very short days and our winter solstice. So these are very important times. As we said, not only, you know, kind of culturally, but also even historically, for example, the development of agriculture, so we could understand the length of the day and plot our seasons and know when to sow certain things. And indeed, so basically our understanding of the Earth's relationship with the sun, its tilt to it, is something actually we've cracked in Ireland even up to 5,000 years ago. And as I said, all caused because we're literally lopsided as we rotate around our axis as we go around the sun.
And Julie, for you, is it all about the land? If we understand this time of year, we understand the land.
We understand the land. It's one of our agricultural festivals. Our last one is 6 weeks ago in Beltane, and our next one, which was a fertility festival, our next one in 6 weeks' time is Lunasa, which is the start of the harvest festivals. So at this time, I suppose, it's our connection with nature and the land. And the last couple of weeks, I've come across so many fledging birds, you know, and the risk taking that they take when they make that flight from the nest. And I suppose the high energy of summer and solstice as well, it encourages us to take flight. It encourages us to take that risk. So when we gather around the bonfire, I suppose there's almost there's just a magic when you gather with all the people around the bonfire, or the tinnichnova, the bonfire, and we connect with our ancestors and we connect with those that went before us, and I suppose the hardships that they went through, our grandparents and great grandparents, and how they went through for us to be here, the privilege of us being here, and we connect with that and we look back. And then we celebrate, so we make daisy chains and we celebrate the flowers and St. John's Wort and Mugwort and Elder and all the blessings of the flowers that we have now. And then we're also at a very important point where the crops for the next 6 weeks, we need good growth, we need a balance of rain and heat
okay.
and sun.
Yeah, and Kevin, the sky is so critical to all we do. And I'm wondering if the Earth's rotation had not been tilted in the way it is, would we have a very different planet, very different seasons?
Yes, we would have had every day the same. We wouldn't have had seasons and we wouldn't have had the changes, as Julie says. So, in fact, this strange happenstance of the Earth is just tilted on its axis has given us our seasons, has given us our solstices, and indeed even the means to be able to understand our position in the cosmos. And whether you're taking that from a kind of a cultural standpoint or a scientific standpoint, they really do meet at the solstices, because they're the times when we understand our position in this, you know, on Earth and its relationship with the sun that basically provides all life and all energy, as Julie says, for us. Whether, you know, you're saying that from a cultural standpoint or even a pure scientific standpoint, they meet in relation to the solstices in the winter and the summer.
And just finally, Julie, how late at night, how late tonight are you expecting there to be light where you are?
Well, last night it was very early because I was supposed to go spend the night in the Blaskets last night, but the weather has been really bad. There was torrential rain. So, I mean, 11 o'clock, you should still have some light outside there. And I just want to say that Grianstad and Tháirg is the Irish for the summer solstice, which means stop. And that's the biggest thing, that this is a 3-day festival every 6 weeks in the Celtic week of the year for us to stop, pause, take it all in.
Well, that's
celebrate.
Good advice. Thank you very much, Julie Nivuela, on the Dingle Druid, Kevin Nolan, astronomer and lecturer in physics at TU.
Pleasure.
Let's join our crime correspondent Paul Reynolds now to talk about an attack in South County Dublin last night in which a man died. Paul, what happened?
Audrey, the Gardaí were called to a house at Carriglee View, which is a housing estate in Fairhouse in South Dublin, last night. Now, I understand the house was rented. A man in his 60s was living there along with a number of other people, unrelated people. Another man in his 30s was visiting there last night when at around 10 minutes to midnight, the man in his 60s was attacked and killed. He appears to have been stabbed. His body remains at the scene this morning. Now, the man in his 30s was arrested on suspicion of murder. He was taken to Tallaght Garda station in the early hours of this morning, detained under Section 4 of the Criminal Justice Act, which means he can be questioned for up to 24 hours. I understand he was seen by a doctor and received medical attention, rested during the night, and the formal interview process will begin later this morning.
Have the Gardaí said anything, Paul?
At this time, they're not looking for anyone else at present. They say they're treating this case as a domestic incident. It appears that the victim and the man in custody are related. The scene has been preserved. A technical examination is to be carried out by the Garda Technical Bureau this morning. The state pathologist will also carry out a post-mortem later today. Now, the Garda have spoken to the other people who are in the house and they're helping them with their investigation. But they've also issued an appeal for anyone with information to come forward. In particular, they're appealing to anyone who is in the Carriglee View area of Fairhouse in Dublin last night between 11:30 and 12:30, half past midnight this morning, to contact them at Tallaght Garda station.
Okay, Paul Reynolds, for now, many thanks indeed. It's